Thank everyone here for coming, and those who are on the Internet, thank you for watching and listening. I beg for your prayers that I may say something useful and beneficial for all of us, including myself, so that we can all achieve the goal of Krishna consciousness, which is to serve Krishna, to please Krishna, to love Krishna. So we'll continue from where we left off. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We left off on text number 17. I would just like to read the translation of 16 just to connect the continuity of the two verses, because they do have a relationship. So let me just read the translation of number 16. Yeah. So there's an argument going on here, and Devayani, who is the daughter of the sage Shukracharya, the priest, chief priest Shukracharya of the Bhrigu dynasty. She has just said some very sarcastic things to one of her friends, or so-called friends, namely Sharmishta. And Sharmishta is now on the retaliation side. So let me just read this. Shukdeva Goswami said, "When thus rebuked in cruel words, Sharmishta was very angry. Breathing heavily, like a serpent, and biting her lower lip with her teeth, she spoke to the daughter of Shukracharya as follows. You beggar, since you don't understand your position, why should you unnecessarily talk so much? Don't all of you wait at my house, depending for us on your livelihood like crows?" So she's the daughter of a king. So Devayani has just put her down, saying that the whole kingdom depends upon her father's blessings. And now Sharmishta is saying, no. Your father can't even eat a meal without my father supplying the food. So the purport was done yesterday, which I won't do again. So we come now to text number 17. I'll just read the translation. There's no purport there. Using such unkind words, Sarmishta rebuked Devayani, the daughter of Shukracharya. In anger, she took away Devayani's garments and threw Devayani into a well. Heavy duty. Remember that this daughter is the daughter of a kshatriya. So she doesn't just use words. She uses her hands. She uses action. That is the nature of a kshatriya, a fighter, a defender. So she's fighting, and real strong. So after throwing Devayani into the well, Sharmishta went home. Meanwhile, King Yayati, while engaged in a hunting excursion, went to the well to drink water, and by chance saw Devayani. By the way, she had no clothes on at that point. Seeing Devayani naked in the well, King Yayati immediately gave her his upper cloth to cover herself so that she can at least have some sense of modesty there. Being very kind to her, he caught her hand with his own and lifted her out of the well. So we'll now go to the first verse of today, and that will be verse number 20. Assume it's on the board. Tam viram mahaushanasi. Prema nirbharaya gira, rajam svaya gihito me, Panipara Puranjayam. Tam Vidam Ahausha Nasi. Prema Nirbharaya Gira. Rajam Svaya Rito Me. Panipara Puranjaya. Tam Vidam Ahausha Nasi. Prema Nirbharaya Gira. Rajam Svaya Grihito Me. Panipara Puranjaya. Please chant. Ladies, please. Synonyms, tam, unto him, viram, yayati, aha, said, osanasi, the daughter of Ushana Kavi, Shukracharya, prema nirbharaya, saturated with love and kindness. Gira, by such words, Rajan, O King, Tvaya, by you, Gritaha, accepted, Me, my, Pani, hand, Parapuranjaya, the conqueror of the kingdoms of others. So that's the last word in that verse. There's another four lines, which I'm not doing, but I will cover the translation of those four lines right now. With words saturated with love and affection, Devayani said to King Yayati, O great hero, O king, conqueror of the cities of your enemies. By accepting my hand, you have accepted me as your married wife. Let me not be touched by others, for our relationship as husband and wife has been made possible by providence, not by any human being. Purport. While taking Devayani out of the well, King Yati must certainly have appreciated her youthful beauty, and therefore he might have asked her which caste she belonged to. Thus Devayani would have immediately replied, "We are already married because you have accepted my hand." Uniting the hands of the bride and bridegroom is a system perpetually existing in all societies. Therefore, as soon as Yayati accepted Devayani's hand, they could be regarded as married. Because Devayani was enamored with the hero Yayati, she requested him not to change his mind and let another come to marry her. The idea being is that he was of the Kshatriya caste and she was of the Brahmin caste. And in those days, it was not the best of form for a Brahmin woman to marry a Kshatriya man, or vice versa. Generally, purity of caste was considered the ideal. But sometimes there were differences, and when a woman was of the higher... Go off by itself? Huh?
You still want it on because it's blinding the
audience. Oh, well, no, it's okay. I just was wondering whether there was some ghost in the airport. Yeah, because it just went off and I didn't see Vijay. I had my eyes closed. You can do that any time. Yeah. So, where was I? Huh? Yes, the purity of caste was very, very important there in those times. It kept the qualities, at least that was the idea, that the qualities would be maintained, supposedly. And if it was a very strict and very pure Brahmin family, generally speaking, it would be transmitted from father to son or from mother to son or daughter. And there would be a purity. But sometimes when you have a Kshatriya marrying a Brahmin, Kshatriyas, as we know, tend to be a little more passionate, and therefore there may be some conflict there, in conflict in understanding, conflict in opinion, conflict in conclusions. So the idea is to avoid that and to try to have a happiest possible marriage. And in the succeeding purports, Srila Prabhupada makes that point very clearly. We have some examples of what we call, this is called a sutta marriage, when the woman or the female is of a higher caste than the male. We have a few examples of this. We have Ramaharshana Sutta, we have Sutta Goswami, and it was also thought, and quite wrongly, it was thought that Karna was a Sutta since his mother, at least his family mother, not his biological mother. He didn't know who his biological mother was until the beginning of the Battle of Kurukshetra. His mother, whose name was Radha, she was of the Brahmin caste, and his father was a Kshatriya. He was basically a charioteer. So he was considered a Sutta, and as I just mentioned, generally speaking, the caste system was such that a woman had a right to demand that the man that she married be of the same caste, or if it turned out that the man looked very, very personable, very heroic, very powerful, and very desirable, then she could also request the other as well. It was up to her. And in that contest where different kings were challenging one another for the hand of Draupadi, if you all remember, the object was to string a bow and shoot an arrow up and towards the ceiling in that arena, and there was a wheel rotating, and between two of the spokes there was a fish, and so the idea was to hit the fish in the eye, ideally, and bring it down while the wheel was rotating. So everybody knew that if anyone could do it, it was Karna and it was Arjuna. So when Karna stepped up to the plate, as they say, he picked up the bow very easily. Most of the other Kshatriyas, they could not even lift it, what to speak of stringing it. And he was gigantic. He was, remember, the son of the sun god. I mean, these are not ordinary-looking mortals, ordinary human beings. Huge shoulders, big chests, kind of waspy-like waists, no excess of eating. And they didn't walk. They kind of pranced, you know, like lions. If you've ever seen lions prancing back and forth in their cages, they have that heroic look about them. So when he picked up, he was ready to, then next thing was to shoot the arrow at the fish. Draupadi had said, stop, stop, stop. So he looked at her as if, what's going on? So she said, no, I cannot marry ever the son of a Suta. See, a Suta was considered, I was checked with the Gopi Pranadan. I said, well, what's so bad about a Suta? He says, well, they were considered outcasts in their times. So in other words, there's caste and then there's out of caste. When you have two persons who are of two different castes, sometimes it works out very well and sometimes it doesn't. So that's what that was her basis. And he never forgot that. He had such vengeance for her because he wanted to marry her. And of course, we know that Arjuna, he did the same thing. He stepped up and shot the arrow. The fish came down and she was awarded to him. So, never having forgotten that, he had such vengeance that when there was a gambling match that had gone on in the assembly room, Yudhishthira kept losing and losing and losing. Finally, he lost Draupadi. And out of this vengeance, out of this hatred, out of this wanting to get back at her, Duryodhana told his brother Dushasan, you take her clothes off in front of this assembly. In other words, dishonor her. She doesn't deserve any honor. That was his position. She's a princess. You know, she has father's Drupada, king. It's just not something you do to a princess, but they had such hatred and they were so low-minded. Anyway, they never succeeded because Drupadi, as we all know, she prayed to Krishna and Krishna extended the length of her sari unlimitedly until Dushasan, after about a half hour of huffing and puffing and huffing and puffing, finally gave up in despair because her honor would not be dishonored because Krishna protected it. Even though her husbands, who had been basically won in the gambling match. So we have this mixed caste situation which comes up. There are other incidents in our Vedic literature in which we see those things happening. But now coming back to the incident that just has occurred, which is really a bit fascinating. We have two young women, about 15 years old, about. And they're all playing, you know, there must be, who knows, 50 or 100 girls just playing and frolicking and bouncing balls and shouting and running. And then they all went in, they decided they were, you know, perspiring and they jumped into the water and they were bathing and they didn't have any clothes on and so forth. So what happened was that actually if you go into the Mahabharata, you find out that Indra, he was at work here. And what he did is he invisibly, he blew all the clothes all about so that, you know, some of the yellow saris would get mixed up with the yellow saris. And if you weren't looking very closely, you could pick up a yellow sari of somebody else. And that's exactly what Sarmishta did. She picked up, she picked up Devyani's sari. So here we have a very good example of a young girl who's very, very proud of her position. I mean, her position is, I am the daughter of the chief of the priests. It is through the blessings of my father that everyone here eats. It is the blessing of my father that this kingdom goes on. I mean, this is her mentality. And being a daughter of a Brahmin, she considered herself superior. And generally speaking, Brahmins were considered considered the highest of caste. But this mentality is not Brahmin mentality. This mentality is a lower than Shudra mentality. And this is what Srila Prabhupada talks about so often in his books, that it is our qualities which really determine, and Narada Muni makes that point in one of his verses, it's the qualities that we manifest, the characteristics that we manifest that really determine our true caste. Even though externally we may be labeled, you know, you're a Brahmin because your father and mother are Brahmins, but if you're exhibiting the qualities of an outcast, or the qualities of an untouchable, one who has no culture, one who has no refinement, not one who has no knowledge of spiritual etiquette. Therefore, if that's what you are, then that's what you are, Narada Muni says. You may not really think it, that they called it Dvija Bandhu, you know, basically not really Brahman, not really Brahman, but only Brahman in name only. So this is what we have here. Obviously, Devayani did not take any course in anger management, and she just manifested, she exploded. You know, how dare you take, she said to Sharmistra, who picked up her sari, and who knows, they're both in yellow, you know. So, you know, they're coming out of the water because Lord Shiva's passing by. They want to cover themselves up. So, I mean, it's an emotional moment. So she, you know, grabs, you see two yellow saris. I'm not saying they were yellow, but it's very possible if they're two saris that look similar, but not exact. You just grab it quickly and you put it over because you want to, you know, be modest in the face of two great personalities passing, Lord Shiva and his wife. So you don't want to be committing an offense. So therefore, Devayani accused Sharmishta of taking the sari of one who is so much higher than her. How dare you even put your hands on my sari? This was her mentality. So, of course, Sharmishta, as I said, she comes, her father's anybody? Huh? Vishvaparva, yeah, thank you. Vishvaparva, he's a king. So she's been brought up in a kingly household, in a royal household where passion and goodness are both prevalent. So she would not, this is her response, in other words, who are you to talk to me like this? It is my father who protects this kingdom. It is my father who feeds you. It is my father who goes out and wins the battle while your father just sits home and, you know, and chants mantras. We're the ones who's, you know, this retaliatory mentality was clearly there. So the when the push came to shove, shove came to to real shove, and she shoved Devayani down into this well which was there. The poor woman, I mean, she didn't expect that. As I said, the Kshatriyas are very fistic. You know, they don't hold back. Whereas a Brahmin, they go on with their mouth. You know, they've got the verbal skills. They got a language. They got vocabulary. So she didn't think it would just go that far. So there, poor Devayani is lying in the well. Help! Help! Somebody help! And the girls go away. And who comes by but King Yayati? And he hears this beautiful feminine voice coming from somewhere, and as he gets closer, he sees the well, and he sees her, and she's not exactly in fit to be seen by anyone but her husband. And he wants to help her out of the hell, wanted to help her out of the well. But there was a hell, though, no question about that. Poor girl, she didn't know if anybody was going to come and help her out. So, anyway, long story short, he grabbed her by the hand and he lifted her, you know, with this big Kshatriya forearm, just lifted her right up and put her down on the ground. Oh, thank you so much. We are now married. So he said, married? You know, it's like, so she said, well, yes, you took my hand, and this is predicted. This is, I was cursed by the son of Brihaspati, of Kacha, when he was here, and he cursed me that I would never have a Brahmin for a husband. And so you're a Kshatriya, so you're the answer to the curse. So he said, well, wait a minute. He says, just a second. We have to clear this with your dad. I have to clear it with your father, because because before I'm accepting any marriage at this point to you, he said, I want to complete approval by your father. Well, she came and she... So anyway, she explained to Shukracharya exactly what happened and that Yayati had saved her, brought her up out of the well, and she mentioned to her father that this Sharmishta, she had done the unspeakable, the unthinkable. So what happened was that Devayani and her father, Shukracharya, they paid a little visit to Vishvaparva. So he knew what was coming and immediately threw himself at the feet of Shukracharya and Devayani, and he said, "My apologies, please accept my obeisances." He wanted to pacify him because he was wondering what kind of a curse is going to be hurled at him for his daughter, Sharmishta, doing what she did to Devayani. And Shukracharya did have quite a few curses up his sleeve. It wasn't so difficult for him to do that. He knew he could bring people back to life. He had that mantra, Sanjivani, which he did. He brought many demons back to life. So therefore, he was a very threatening, frightful personality. The result was that when Shukracharya and Devayani approached him, and he wanted to extract some consequence or give some punishment. So he said that Devayani is going to marry, gave his approval, is going to marry King Yati, and I want your daughter, Sharmishta, to be a maidservant to my Devayani. In other words, she would wait on her hand and foot, and in other words, she's really being put into a lowly position. So actually, that's what happened. Sharmishta had to pretty much keep her mouth shut. She was under the gun, so to speak, of Devayani. Another thing which was mentioned is that when Shukracharya, he approved the marriage of Yayati and Devayani, he said, "But one thing I want to make very clear, this Sharmishta will be your servant of my daughter, but you are not to have any close, intimate relationships with this Sharmishta." Is that under... Wait, he didn't say that. He said, no intimacy with Sharmishta. So, Yayati didn't say anything. He didn't say yes, he didn't say no. But if he didn't want to, then it was his duty to say, "Well, no, I don't agree with that." But he never said anything, so his non-answer, no answer, was tantamount to approval. Because if you don't want something, you don't like something, you say, "Well, no, I don't agree with that." But since he didn't say that, the appearance that was given was that he accepted it. So what happened as time went on, Devayani had two children. And Sharmishta, she became envious, and she wanted some kids. So she pretty much demanded from Yayati that, "I want some children also." So he was thinking about this. In the Vedic tradition, when a great kshatriya is petitioned by a young damsel for children, that if that kshatriya is able to maintain the woman and her children, then he is duty-bound to give her a child. That's probably, we will be reading that in the next couple of days. He's duty-bound, he must do that. If it can't maintain her, then he's not duty-bound, because actually children should not be brought into this world unless they can be maintained, they can be taken care of, they can be brought up properly, so forth. So he gave her three children. So then she gave, three children. So when Devayani found this out, she told her father. She said, "She's got three kids and I only have two. And he's my husband." So Shukracharya approached Yayati and he said, "Well, what is the meaning of this? You basically said you would not be having any intimacy with Sharmishta when I mentioned this to you? So he says, well, I thought on the basis of religious principles that I should. He says, no, you shouldn't, because you never disagreed with me when I said that you cannot have any intimacy with her. You never said no. So therefore, you had an obligation to be dutiful to my word. So he said, for this sin that you have performed, I now curse you to give up all your youth, and you're going to look like an old, bent-over, scrabbly, diabetic, arthritic old man. So immediately he turned into an old man. But he said, but you have to have a little compassion. I mean, you got to give me a little out. So he says, all right, I'll give you an out. If someone would be willing to exchange his youth for your old age, then you can have the youth and he can take your old age. Whew. Of course, that was for Devayani, because, look, Devayani now had a husband who was decrepit. I mean, what is her future? She's 16 years old and she's with a guy who looks 90 years old. Not much there to look forward to. So that was for her benefit, so she would not become so dried out and dried up that she just didn't even want to live anymore. She wanted, she wanted a youthful husband, Yati. So he gave her the out. So then what happened at that point was then Yati began petitioning the five sons, the two that Devayani had and the three that he had given to Sharmishta. So he asked the two, and then he asked two more, and none of them wanted to give up their youth. They all wanted to maintain it because they hadn't exhausted their sexual desire. You know, when persons are young, that desire is very intense, very strong, and they didn't want to give it up. Just as Yayati, he didn't want to give it up either. Here he is in this old body, and he hasn't exhausted his desire. So finally he came to Puru. Puru was one of his children, the youngest. So Puru said, yes, my father, you can have my youth. I'll take your old age. And therefore Yayati was very, very happy about that. And he would bless Puru. Actually, Puru would become the next king as a result of that. And he was the youngest. Usually the youngest doesn't become the king. Youngest is last on the totem pole to get the kingdom. So, but he received it. The others got kingdoms, but not the kingdom of that we see. Forgot this dynasty. That's what happened. But really, the question is, what can we learn from all this? One of the things that we can learn from this is that we should be very aware of our thinking process. The mind is for thinking, willing. And thinking, feeling, and willing. So the feeling and thinking, when thoughts arise, you can actually hear them. Anyone who's practiced what they call impersonal meditation knows that there's in the eightfold system, there's a one stage called pratyahara. Pratyahara is the ability to see your thoughts and to dismiss them. Until finally, the only thought that exists is that I am dismissing my thoughts. That's the only thing that's left there. The mind is virtually blank with the exception of that one thought. In other words, thoughts are not pouring in as they normally do. There's one thought left that I must not allow any of these other thoughts to come in. The only thought is I must not allow any thought to come in. That's the only thought. That's what Prabhupada makes a big point out of this, is that how can you stop thinking? You must have at least one thought. So anyway, what happened was that what we can learn from this is that we need to be careful. We need to be watchful. Watchful of our thinking process. Watchful of our emotional process. When we feel anger rising, we have to immediately nip it in the bud. We need to stop it right there. If we allow it to continue to rise, so to speak, it started bubbling, and then it explodes. And when it comes out of the mouth in the form of speech, it's too late. It's already been said. And then the other person, if that person is of a passionate nature, will just bite back. And then the biting goes on. And that's what the cause of all wars are. Every war starts out with two people wanting to lord it over, each one wanting to lord it over the other. And that's why we've all come into this world, to be lords, to be masters, to be controllers, to be sense gratifiers. And anyone who robs us, anyone who lessens our experience of sense gratification, or controllership, or ownership, or friendship, is diminishing our sense of lordship. Lordship means all those things that I just said. So, when we win, when we gain money, and wealth, and power, beauty, education, degrees, when we gain these different fame, our lordship is expanding. And people are happy when they have that. People, thousands of people are worshiping me, glorifying me, honoring me. My pictures in the newspaper, in the magazines, on the internet. Persons feel big. And when the fame begins to shrink, people again begin to feel very small, less of a lord, as if what they have come into this world for is now becoming less and less. In other words, instead of lordship, one is becoming an ordinary person, which is the fear, which is the dread of every human being, that I should be an ordinary person. And for everyone is striving in one way or another for some degree of exceptionalism. They want to do something different, something great, something powerful. Sometimes you will see on the television news, you know, the newscaster is giving play by play of what's going on, and behind the newscaster there's a guy or a girl going like this, hey, 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 you know, saying hello to the family. They want to be seen. They want to be noticed. Hey, did you see me on TV? Yeah, millions of people are watching me on TV. They think that's important. They think that's some value. They think that's, you know, they can go back to that newscast, you know, 50 years from now and say, there I was, millions of people were looking at me. Just see my opulence. Big opulence, really. So this is what people live for. This is their false happiness. But real happiness comes from the marriage of the soul with the supreme soul, which comes through surrender, comes from sacrifice, it comes from affection, it comes from dedication, comes from devotion. It comes from immolating or completely eliminating the sense, false sense of I am my body. And the more humble, the more modest, the more unassuming I become, the more I fulfill the true purpose of my life. Because we cannot experience real happiness, true happiness, high happiness, great happiness, unless the soul has been disabused or disassociated from all the coverings of lust and anger and greed and envy and illusion and all of these things. Unless it's completely free of these things, there is no way that the soul can experience its true, its real identity as a being that is blissful by nature, peaceful by nature, and knowledgeable by nature. This is the nature of the soul. But we are not experiencing that purity, and that is the result of the coverings, because we want to be a lord rather than want to serve the Lord. And as soon as we no longer want to serve the Lord, then what happens? We're thrown into this world and covered over. And the result is we have the illusion that we are all lords. We all think that we are accomplishing something. I'm the doer. You know, I just distributed 300 books today. So this is an illusion. Krishna is allowing you to think that you distributed 300 books today. You didn't distribute anything. Krishna set it up. He arranged it. He enabled you to with the skill. So he gave you the skill. He approved it, permitted it, and then he, as I said, he arranged it, and it happened. as a result of what he thinks you should have based upon your attitude, based upon your affection for him, based upon past activities that were performed. Krishna is giving and he is taking away. Some are doing well, some are not doing well. For 2 or 3 hours, someone is doing nothing. And then suddenly there's a flood. So this has all come from Krishna's arrangement. He gives us the illusion that we're the doer because we want to be the doer. We want to be the Lord. We want to be all-powerful. We want to be all-knowing. We want to usurp his position. So he says, you want my position? Here, take the illusion. Hey, I did this. Hey, I did that. I did this. Look at my score. Look at my siddha. Nonsense. We're forgetting the real doer. Krishna is in the heart and he's allowing, he's enabling. And he's arranging. And we're taking the credit. When the devotee actually grows into maturity, he realizes, what am I taking the credit for? This all goes to Krishna. Krishna says you have the right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. Never consider yourself to be the cause of the results of your action. Well, who is the cause of the results of your action? It's Krishna. So, ascribe it to me. Assign it to me. When the good result comes, don't say, wow, I did great. Wow, just see my lines. Oh, just see what I did. Just see my attitude. It's all due to me, mine. And this is the madness that we all fall into. We should not think because we're devotees, well, that's not me. We learn from this wonderful pastime that it is us in greater or lesser degree. And when we are completely free of this idea that I am the doer, remember, you can't blink your eyes without Krishna's mercy. You can't speak without Krishna's mercy. You can't walk without Krishna's mercy. You can't think without Krishna's mercy. You can't arrange anything without his mercy. He gives you the energy in your brain, you can think. If he takes the energy out of your brain, they put you in a mental hospital as a catatonic schizophrenic. And you look like this all day. Or you keep your arm up like this all day. I'm not joking. It's serious. I saw movies of these things. You can't think. No thinking process. Krishna is in charge and we should be very, very thankful. Very, very grateful. As Sura was saying yesterday, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you in his class. Thanking Krishna for countless blessings we're getting, which is enabling us to purify ourselves of all that dross, all that filth that covers the soul. And when that soul is completely cleansed by the bar of devotional service, by the soap bar of devotional service, when it's completely cleansed of it, and there is a feeling of total refreshment, total upliftment, total salutary, sublime blissfulness, when we have that feeling, then we know what real life, real happiness, true happiness is, as it's mentioned in the Bhagavad Gita, if you can remember that. A liberated person is not attracted to material sense enjoyment, but is always entranced, enjoying the pleasure within. In this way, the self-realized soul enjoys unlimited happiness, for he concentrates on the Supreme Lord. That's where the unlimited happiness is. So if we're distributing books, or we're cooking, or we're dressing the deities, our only thought should be, oh my dear Lord, help me to do it well, help me to do it greatly, help me to do it in such a way that you will be pleased by it. Because if you are pleased by it, then my heart will become cleansed because you will give me your blessings. When I have that blessing of cleanliness, I will be able to do possibly more service, better service, higher service, and please you even more. So I beg you, please, help me to remember you. There's service, there's devotional service, there's loving devotional service. They are not the same, they are not on the same level. Service is just what it says, service, and it's good. Anyone who does devotional service is doing something beneficial and is gaining some benefit. But the person who does devotional service, in other words, he's involving the heart to some extent. He's actually thinking of Krishna. That's it. He's thinking of Krishna. And then you have loving devotional service where actually he wants so much to please Krishna and he's communicating. Whether he's getting an answer or not is irrelevant. But he's communicating with the Lord and he's begging the Lord, please enable me to do it well so that I can give you more pleasure today than I did yesterday. That is the goal. That is why we're here. That's what we should be trying to achieve. Loving, these are Prabhupada's words, loving devotional service. So when it's full of love, that means we want the very best for Krishna. And if we are conscious of that, that we want the very best for Krishna, we will be attentive to what is necessary, what is needed, what we require to give the best. If we are simply doing service, we will just do what we know, and that's it. One who wants to get the best, the very best, will get guidance, will get direction from within. That's what Krishna says to those who are constantly devoted to serving me with love. I give them the understanding by which they may come to me to show them special mercy. I, dwelling in their hearts, destroy with the shining lamp of knowledge the darkness born of ignorance. This is what Krishna does. He gives to those as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. So you don't surrender much, you don't get much. You surrender more, you get more. It's as simple as that. Krishna wants to give his everything to everyone, but everyone doesn't deserve. As Prabhupada so often says, first deserve and then, what is it? Then desire, yes. Deserve it. Deserve it means put your life on the line and don't think you're doing anything, because we owe not one life but millions of lives to Krishna. He is so compassionate, so kind, so sweet, so loving. We're all here together, peaceful, calm. No ceilings falling down, no bombs going off. How grateful we should feel. So this is the real Thanksgiving, that every moment is Thanksgiving. There's no question of the Thanksgiving day. It's a Thanksgiving moment. And if we're constantly being thanking Krishna for the next moment will go better. And the next moment will go better. And what does that mean? Better and better and better and better. We become fully Krishna conscious. We're full of bliss, full of peace, full of strength, full of love. No one can affect us. No one can disturb us. No one can shake us. No one can rattle us. No one can upset us, because we are in the sunlight of Krishna consciousness. When we come out of the sunlight, go into the cloudy darkness, then we can be affected. So I thank you all very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Any questions? Anyone have a question? I know I talked over. I always do. Big mouth. No? No question? Just stretching? Somebody got a question? Yeah. Good and loud, Prabhu, because, you know.
What about if somebody takes that desire for distinction and applies it to their experience that they want Krishna to...
They want what? They want to be what? Seen by Krishna?
Yeah, they want to be recognized in society. Like is it transcendental if somebody has the desire to be
recognized
by Krishna?
Yeah.
Is that okay?
No. Our only business is to lovingly serve. But we shouldn't have any desire to recognize me. That's egocentric already, right there. To be truly a servant is that I always consider my services pretty worthless and useless. And therefore we beg for the mercy to be able to be useful, to be valuable in our service. That way, not I will be recognized. If I am recognized, I don't even take the credit mentally. Externally, I bow my head, put my palms together. Thank you very much. Thank you. But inwardly, no, it's not mine. It belongs to you, Krishna. You see, devotee wants to be just a nobody, really. He enjoys being a nobody because he wants Krishna to be the somebody. And that's what only one... Well, of course, it doesn't mean he doesn't recognize the great devotees of Krishna, because it means Krishna is manifesting through those devotees. Therefore, we worship them, we honor them, we glorify them, because Krishna is coming through them. That's the main point, you see. But we ourselves don't want to be recognized. We don't care for recognition. Many devotees, they just want to plug up their ears when they hear themselves praised, because they're genuinely humble. They know Krishna is so great, whatever greatness is coming out of them, it's coming from Krishna. So he gives all credit to Krishna. And that way, that's what Krishna consciousness means. He gets it all. But we get a lot too, because he reciprocates out of compassion, out of affection, out of love. Okay?
Hare Krishna.
Anyone else?
Yeah. Yes, many places Prabhupada says that if you distribute books, then you'll very quickly be recognized by Krishna.
Yes.
So it appears like it's good. The devotee wants to be recognized by Krishna as a sincere servant.
You don't have to want to be. If you do it, simply Krishna knows it. The books are about him. And what you're doing is distributing something about him. So, of course, he's going to recognize you. There's no harm in that. But one doesn't have to desire to be recognized by Krishna. Anytime we do any devotional service, as I said, I gave three different types. Even the lowest type of devotional service will be recognized by Krishna. But there are different degrees of recognition and different degrees of blessing that we receive. So, yeah, there's no... But you don't have to desire that. It's an automatic. As you just said, Prabhupada said that Krishna will recognize, and that's a fact. So I don't have to desire that. It's automatic. Anytime you glorify Krishna, he's pleased. Because we're coming closer to him in love, and that's really all he wants of us, to love him. Okay? Any more? No? Oh, I see one more question. Yes, go ahead, Prabhuji.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. In the story you mentioned, like the story, the main root cause of the story is the anger, right? And also you mentioned like you need to be very careful with
your
feelings.
You're going to have to come up. I'm not hearing that. Come closer. Or either raise the mic or come. Could you come up closer, Prabhu? Is that otherwise, I'll come close to you.
No, no, that's fine.
It's going to be one or the other. No, it's going to be one or the other. Because if I say come closer, you should just come closer or speak louder. Yeah. Thank you. Because I want everybody to hear this, not only just yourself. Yeah, go ahead.
So in the story, like the main problem with the story is the anger, right? Like the anger caused a lot of issues and
yes.
things like that. So later you mentioned that like you need to be very careful with your feelings.
Yes. Right. Yeah, so thank you. It's a good question. How do you overcome this? So how do you prevent it from happening? That's what you're asking, really. Yeah, prevent it by becoming Krishna conscious. I already just said, the last things I said in my talk today is that when you become fully Krishna conscious and you live in the sunlight of Krishna consciousness, nothing affects you. You're not of the material world anymore. You're just in it. Okay? You're in the spiritual world. You're in spiritual consciousness. You know you're not the body. You know no one. You know you don't die. You know no one can affect you. It's the idea that I can die that makes me explode. You're threatening this little body that I want to lord it over the world with. So if I feel a threat, then I explode back to you. But if I feel no threat because I know I'm not the body, I am the soul, I experience myself as soul, then there is nothing to be frightened about, and I just peacefully just listen, and thank you very much. Have a great day. Hare Krishna. The way it works. I can tell you very fast, it's too late now, stories like that have happened to devotees I know, to myself as well. Hare Krishna. So you don't worry, it's coming. You're on the way.